Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, September 18th, year 2000. And this morning in the fireside is Philip Dean, MD. And he will be presenting Faith in Medicine, New Dimensions in the New Millennium, Part 1. The session number is PHDE 2000-1. Now let's just sit back, relax, and have a little listen.
My name is Phil Dean. And I live on Shaw Island. I was born and raised in Western Massachusetts, Greenfield. Started college at Mass State, where Mrs. Bragg lives. Went in the Army, then the ski troops. Went to Middlebury College. Was very involved in competitive skiing. And went to medical school at Yale University. And subsequently trained as both internal medicine and pediatrics and pediatric cardiology. I ended up doing general pediatrics and mostly, and then retired at age 62 from my remunerative practice, and Lola and I worked the next 10 years in third world countries teaching and giving service. So we are not experts in the field that we're talking about. We're going to present material to you that's from other people. However, we do have opinions, and we expect you folks to have opinions. And so there's going to be a lot of discussion.
I'm Lola Dean, and I have had several lives, all encompassed in the same one. But I started out being a native of the state of Washington, going to the nearest school of nursing, which happened to be the University of Washington, because I knew I wanted to go as far with it as I could. And it turned out to be, and still is, the best nursing school in the nation, both baccalaureate and graduate. I started my undergraduate degree and happened to meet Phil halfway through. And that sort of put a little monkey wrench into things. But I did finish pregnant with my second child. We had six children, so I spent the next few years doing what I think all of us have done, home with children, did a lot of volunteer work. I was a merchant. I started a bookstore with my family. We had a family-owned bookstore, and started the bookstore here at Holden a couple years after we started our store. Our store is still going. It's a small independent bookstore. I do want you to always patronize small independent bookstores. Amazon.com is okay to look it up, but go to your little bookstore to make sure they survive. As we were our children were growing up and going off, decided that we wanted to do something different with our lives, so I went back to graduate school in the nurse practitioner program. So I am truly an alternative medicine person, in that the recognized medical world didn't recognize nurse practitioners for quite a long time. Now they are very well recognized, and in our state operate as independent practitioners. I finished that, and then worked for a tribe, a Native American Indian tribe, near Seattle in Marysville, Washington, for 3 years, and then we went off and worked overseas for a period of 7 years, and then back and got bored after being home on our little island for a year, went back to the reservation for another 3 years. So that has been my professional life. My other life is I'm a spinner and a knitter and a weaver and anything to do with textiles, and outside of that, I'll travel at any drop of a hint.
Okay, a few words about how we're conducting the course here. I'm going to present today, and the others will present. We'll all join in discussion. If you have a burning question that seems to fit in the context of the presentation, why, raise your hand and we'll discuss it right there. We would definitely have most of our discussion time at the end, so that and we'll all we're going to focus a great deal on the discussion part.
We need to tell the tape.
No. We haven't started yet. And we will, after 45 minutes, we'll have a five-minute break. You're not allowed to leave the building. But people like to stretch a little bit, and the bathrooms are down the hall at the end. And we'll be through at 10 o'clock in time for the real coffee break up in the dining room. Okay, to the tape person, you can start the tape rolling. We will start by talking about, let's get my paper separated. This is Faith in Medicine. And I want to talk a little bit about the history of medicine and spiritual care. As you probably remember, the archaeoanthropologists feel that shamanism started over 20,000 years ago. And the shaman were people that handled both the spiritual and the medical side of things, rudimentary as they were. And then remember that Christ had a very definite ministry in healing. And after the Christian church got started, healing ministry continued to be a prominent feature. And then something happened. In 313 A.D., Emperor Constantine declared the Roman Empire to be officially Christian. And at that point, the persecution of Christians diminished. And people who were not as zealous didn't have as much faith to accept the persecution came in to be Christians. And there were a lot of nominal Christians. And the concept of health ministry seemed to decline. And then a couple of hundred years later, as you remember, the Muhammad appeared and the Muslim world began their ministry. And the health care was a very strong part of it. As you probably remember, every mosque of any size had shops in it to support the economics of the mosque, but also they had a hospital, a lunatic asylum, as they called it, and outpatient facilities for healing. So that there has been a very definite healthcare feature with tied to religion for a long time. Then remember, we are fans of Ellis Peters, the author who writes about Brother Cadfael. And this is in the medieval times, 1200 A.D. And you remember the health care was done at the monastery. A monk was knowledgeable and so on. So again, a relationship between medicine and religion. Along came the concept that seemed to snowball that the soul was the most important thing, and the body was of less importance. And so that in spiritual terms, people tend to disregard the health factor in the organized religion. And an example of this were the Puritans, who felt that ill health was a retribution for sin, and therefore not to be regarded. What you do is you heal your soul so that your health can be restored. Anyway, we need to sort of define health before we go on. And one author says, health is more than the absence of disease. Just as courage is more than the absence of fear, and just as wisdom is more than the absence of ignorance. And Pelican up here in his book cites three examples of health. the lack of physical suffering, good functional ability, and what he calls good coherence, which is positive attitude, optimism. So those are the rudiments of good health, and I think we might use different terms, but we can agree sort of that those are all building blocks of health. And a healer, therefore, and I think we had allusion to that from Cliff just a minute ago, requires more than the technical cure of the disease, that you need to be aware of the social and cultural background of the person, you know, you don't want to give blood to a Jehovah's Witness and all such things. Need to look at the background, the social context, and where the suffering's coming from, as well as where the pain of the illness is. So supporting the positive attitude is part of it, and I think medicine is becoming aware of this aspect of medical care. Now then, spirituality. We're talking about the spiritual aspect of life in relation to healing and health. And we need to look at what is spirituality. And a lot of people say, well, it's organized religion. Well, that is an organized social entity dealing with spiritual life. But spirituality is personal. And it's an attitude of an individual. And according to Miller here, it is the attitude of an individual and includes his or her search for what is holy, sacred, and includes a search or relationship with a higher power. And in healthcare, it's quoting Miller again, it's important to have good scientific treatment, but also it needs to have augmentation of the patient's spirituality. And a physician needs to be well-grounded in the scientific medicine and the technical aspects, but needs also to be aware of this aspect, to be non-judgmental, have accepting, empathetic attitude and relationship with the patient, an openness and understanding of the patient and his spirituality, be familiar with the patient's culturally related values, and be comfortable in asking about the patient's spiritual issues, and be willing to seek information from appropriate other professionals, like referrals, and coordinate the care of the patient health, the physical health, as well as their spiritual traditions.
Pretty tall order, isn't it?
It is a tall order, and I would say that the modern medical school, particularly when I went to medical school, did not address any of these issues other than, you know, just the strict scientific care of the disease. There is an effort being made now in, I think, 23 of the medical schools where they do have required classes in focusing on the spiritual aspect of the patient, which is a real advance. I don't know which medical schools they are, in case anyone's interested in joining. Now, in 1996, the National Institute of Healthcare Research convened a series of panels of specialists. The specialists were people involved in the physical medicine, physical aspects of medicine, the mental health, and substance abuse therapists. And the overall conclusions were that spiritual involvement has consistently been positively related to health. Now, we take a look at the specialty of psychiatry. Psychiatry traditionally has been negatively oriented to the things that we're talking about, the relationship of spirituality and religion and health. Freud said religion is a neurosis. Another prominent psychiatrist, Albert Ellis, as recently as 1980, described religion saying it's correlated with emotional disturbance due to inflexibility. Most current psychiatrists downplay the positive relationship of religion and mental health. A partial explanation of this might be found in a survey that was done that showed of all American people of all ages, 94-97%, depending on which issue you're, which study, averaging 95% of people say that belief in a higher power is important to them. Whereas psychiatrist poll, only 43% said they believed in a higher power and it was important to them. So that apparently are a larger percentage of atheists in the psychiatric community than in the community at large. It comes up then, does religion have a negative aspect on health? And the answer to that has to be yes in certain instances. An example would be some very flagrant ones like the Jimmy Jones cult, you know, that was highly religious people and was turned out to be, you know, about as detrimental to your health as you can get. Another one, Heaven's Gate, which went to the extreme of, you know, committing suicide. Those are extreme examples, but obviously there, I think we've probably all seen people that are so zealous in their faith that they sort of have tunnel vision and refuse to accept appropriate health care when they really need it. And I don't think that we need to focus and cast aspersions on Christian Science, which has some very good features, but I think we probably all have heard of instances where it was carried to the point where there was a calamity because they didn't focus on the medical aspects and get appropriate care. We had a neighbor whose child died with from a burst appendix, and the child did not survive the praying for him. And that child would have done better to have been prayed for and had his surgery. My opinion. In Carnett's book, Is Religion Good for Your Health? He feels Americans are becoming less religious. And in 1944, there was a Gallup poll that showed 58% of people claimed that religion was an important part of their lives. And 40 years later, in 1954, In 1954, 75% of people said religion was very important in their lives and in their health. And in 1994, 58%. So we dropped from 75 to 58% in this Gallup poll survey. However, when you look at age groups, the elderly, the feeling of religion being important in the health went up. And it's this has some important features because the elderly are becoming a larger and larger percentage of the population all the time. And in 1990, only 4% of the population was over 65 years of age. And in 1990, it was 12.5%, more than three times greater. They figure that it'll double again in another 20 years. And beyond that, the percentage of elderly who are disabled is rising at an even faster rate. And they figure in 1980 we had about 2 million disabled elderly. And in this year, there's already been a survey done, there's 4 million, they feel. And in 40 years from now, they figure there's going to be 12 million elderly who are disabled. So that adds to the concept of the increasing reliance on religion in health rather than decreasing. Now, a Duke University survey of hospital patients, 40% said that religion was the most important factor in allowing them to cope with their illness. That's 40%. Now, there have been 23 studies in the past 26 years that, and of those 23, 21 showed that persons who are religious had greater well-being. Now, I'm always suspicious of just blanket discussion like that without specifics and documentation. I could not find documentation of that, but I'll report to you what Koenig said in his book. A different series of Duke University surveys showed that religious patients had less depression, had increased life satisfaction, increased self-esteem and self-worth, a diminished amount of anxiety, and decreased alcoholism were some of the things that were focused on. And they think that these good effects are mediated by a sense of increased ability to hope and a sense of personal control over one's destiny, which seemed to me sort of contrary, that normally you'd have more feeling that your higher power had more control of your destiny than your personal. But that's what that said. There's more social support, and I think we all can recognize that. The feeling of the church group and others who think of holding is, someone gets sick, there's a lot of rallying around and support, and that's a very positive feature. And the other thing is that people who are religious are generally more selfless, more feeling about focusing on others than themselves, which is a means to me less whining about their health and focusing on it, more positive attitude. I thought that we might just stop here and just see if anyone had questions or comments, any negative thoughts, positive thoughts about any of the things that I've said.
I think that Bill Moyer special that just finished,
yes,
they had a much higher percentage of people that gave importance to religion than your statistics in the 85 or
75.
Yeah. Well, there was a difference. There was a conflict between whether you felt that, the first statistic you said, that 95% of Americans felt that belief in a higher power was important in their lives, whereas only, I think it was 54% or 58% believed in religion, and you know, took it an organized religion. So, I'm not sure, I watched Bill Moyers thing, whether there's a difference between spirituality and religion.
Yeah.
I think that's the distinction that Bill is making.
Religion technically is the actual practice of what you believe. And spirituality is a personal, like you said, it's a personal sense of spirit and faith. But religion, technically, is how you carry out and practice what you believe, whether it's God or pagan or whatever, but it is the practice of it. So that's the difference in the two.
I
had a couple of comments. When you first began, you were talking about health, and then you mentioned medicine. And I think one of the things that we do in all aspects of our lives is we don't tend to think about the words that we use in relationship to what we're talking about. And so we tend to talk about medicine. But medicine, to me, is the application of some kind of chemical or element to my life. And health is the condition of my being, spiritual, mental, emotional, physical. So I think that one of the things we need to do to really, when we talk about affecting positive health care, is to think about the terminology that we use. And we do this in all aspects of our life, whether it's health or education or whatever. But to me, medicine is an application, and health is a condition and a being. So I think that's one thing we need to think about when we're talking about health. And then you listed the things, you gave the definition of a physician, I believe it was, and you said that's a tall order to live by. The one thing that was missing there that I felt was that I am in partnership with someone. A physician is someone that I am in partnership with. And I don't think we emphasize that aspect of it in our healthcare system here in our culture. And the first time I talked to a physician this way, he just sat there with his mouth gaping open. And I belonged to an HMO at the time, and they had an interview type of meeting with the physician, and he was asking me about my health. And when he finished and he thought he was done, I said, no, we're not done yet, because I have some questions about you. And then I laid out the conditions under which he would be my physician. And if he was okay with that, then we were going to be okay. And that was that this was my life and my body, and he was an expert in certain areas, and he was to give me information, I would give him information, but the final decision was mine.
Yeah, right.
And I don't think he said, nobody's ever done this before. It's just the way it is.
More and more people are doing it that way. And it's putting a great stress, I can tell you personally, it's putting a great stress on the medical profession, because it takes more time. It takes more consideration. It takes an effort on the part of both partners in this to get to know each other. And when you're allotted 7 minutes or 8 minutes in your HMO visit,
right.
And you have a problem that you also want to get taken care of, as well as develop this relationship. And those relationships develop really over time.
Yeah.
And with a mobile society and insurances that shift you around, it becomes increasingly difficult to develop that relationship.
But I think the authors should begin to think about that in terms of when you're writing this. A lot of people read that, and the way we've been raised and conditioned is the physician knows it all, and you know, you're there to do what the physician says, and that's not the way a lot of people feel. But until we start conditioning and educating people to think about their own responsibility for their health.
Well, so that you realize that there are some exceptions to the portrayal that you gave.
Yeah.
In my practice, I initiated the conversation that you were talking about, and that we talked about with every patient that this is a partnership, and you have a responsibility to me as well as I have a responsibility to you, and I am not pontificating to you. We work together to solve this problem. And this allows much more appropriate visits to the for illness and so on, because they know when to come,
yes,
and they know when to ask for advice over the phone, get advice, and be spared the necessity of coming into the office.
Right, and that gives you, the physician, more time to spend with those that you need to be there.
But there was something that was lost a few years ago. In, I think most of us remember our old family physician.
Yes.
And that would come in and say, well, now, how are you? I had an aunt who died just a few years ago, and we took her to a new doctor because she didn't have someone. And she went to him for a few times, and then she said, Lola, he never touches me.
Yes.
I don't want to go to him anymore. And I said, okay. And so, you know, we changed, because I knew that if I didn't, she'd do it anyway. But this is a good part of it, that that got lost in this time problem that we, that most of the medical world deals with now. It is changing. It's changed in nursing, too. They don't have the time either, but nurses have always had a little more time to spend with patients than doctors have. And that's been, nursing is to nurse, to take care of. So that is, that whole factor is now coming around. When Phil had worked with mother, you were working with mothers or fathers, there was a third person involved, and that was the child. So those two had to communicate about this third person. And with older people, many times as we get really older, it's often the physician and a, and one of the patient's children who are talking about the older person. So there's all of these changes that have occurred. Hopefully we're going to come back to something where people are able to spend a little more time and have trust, because it's the trust factor that got lost.
Carl?
Bill, I caught from your remarks that we should assume that there is some importance given to the figures, 75% and 54%. And I'm cautious about that. And I'll tell you why. Just a few centuries ago, human beings, to a large percentage, maybe up to 99%, had faith in two concepts. That was an unshakable faith, and a faith which was based on observation, keen observation, but not sufficient. And those two concepts were, one, that the world was flat, and that the sun revolved around the earth. They're both wrong, but 99% of the people, I'm sure, 400 or 500 years ago, before Newton and Copernicus and those persons came into the picture, would say, well, the earth is flat, and the sun goes around it. But it ain't so. So how much faith can I have in figures that you present about how much these opinions are about spirituality and faith?
Well, you're talking about, you know, apples and oranges here, because the you're talking about the physical world, and it as it is, regardless of how we perceive it. And we're talking about attitudes. And so it's a little more reliable to take a view of attitudes. If you took the view of attitudes of people in the circumstance you're talking about, you know, most of them think the earth is flat. Okay, that's an attitude. We haven't talking about a reality.
Can I make a comment? I think what Phil's trying to do is kind of give a broad overview, and I don't think his statistics are meant to be taken as law. Or, I mean, it's just kind of a general presentation he's giving of attitudes. Yeah.
I think we can.
Opinions of people.
Yeah, right. Right.
They
exactly.
Are.
Exactly.
They are.
And you can't measure that precisely.
But what you can measure indices of health. And you can measure survival. And I'd just like to expand on and I will pass this out. It was published by Consumer Reports, but it does show a graphic representation of a study that was done at Dartmouth with 250 or 230 consecutive open-heart patients. And they asked these patients, do you belong to an organized religion and do you actively participate in it? Do you just have religious beliefs but don't participate in it? Do you have a social support system, or do you not have none of neither of those things? You don't have a good support, because many of us, at least in medicine, have felt, gee, the advantage of religion is the same as being in a social support system. Because if you are in a support system, you generally do better. Your health is better if you have a good support system. If you're in a religion, your health is better. Well, they broke this down into the groups, and it turns out the people who did the best had the lowest lowest mortality rate following surgery, 14 times lower than those that had neither of these, no support, no religion, were those people that were actively practicing religion, had a belief system, were actively involved in a support system. And it sort of was gradated up so that if you had a support system, you did better than if you didn't have a support system. But if you had both a religious belief and a support system, then you did the best. And those data are pretty good. And so it points out maybe there really is something to this having a religious belief in over and above belonging to a congregation or belonging to some kind of a support system.
I think that's a very valuable series of statements, but it does focus on the value of a support system rather than the value of individual faith.
It does both. Because those that had just faith by itself, without any, I mean, they just said, yeah, I'm a spiritual person, I don't go to church, and I don't belong to the Elks or Kiwanis or anything, and I don't have any friends, they did better. They did better than those that that said, you know, I don't have any friends, but I also don't believe in God. So having that belief seemed to add something to survival.
Yeah. And it's certainly a complex formula that we have to go through.
Yeah.
One question about bibliography.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to see that almost typically everything on there is in the last few years, and certainly within the last decade or so. I noticed Norman Cousins is not represented, and I wonder if there's a reason for that or just the...
That comes tomorrow.
Okay, thank you. I'll wait.
One more question, then we'll have a break.
Just two comments for Phil to support what he said. We know developmentally in the middle years of our lives, between 40 and 50, one of the developmental stages for healthy aging or healthy growing as we get older is to question who we are spiritually. And people who are involved in successful aging between the ages of 40 and 50 look at who they are spiritually. They look at inside of them and where they have gone and what they're doing and where they're going in the future. The other thing that you mentioned about people who feel like they have greater control because they have spirituality in their life, they've made a conscious choice to believe something, and that gives them control. And how they act that spirituality out gives them control. So they have ownership of something. Receiving the gift of Christ in your life, you've received the gift, you've made a choice. And with that comes responsibility and action. So those two things that you said have good scientific studies that show that that's why older people tend to be more spiritual, because they're developmentally moving on.
Good. Okay, we'll have just a few minute break. Get a drink of water, whatever. State Ministry people, we're ready to start again. Can we have your attention, please? I think we'll start in. I want to give you a bunch of statistics now. The 1996 poll by USA Today Weekend and Time said 4/5 of patients believed in the healing power of prayer. 2/3 of people interviewed wanted their doctor to address spiritual issues with them. And at East Carolina University, Dr. Dana King did a study where 48% of hospitalized patients wanted their doctor to discuss spiritual issues with them and to pray with them. 48% in his study. We can comment on that later. patient's spirituality leads to improvement in their health conditions by staying healthy and avoiding disease. They recover faster with fewer complications. They live longer. They handle life-threatening illness with increased peacefulness and less pain. They avoid mental illness, such as depression and anxiety, through decrease in stress. They avoid alcohol, drugs, and tobacco. They have happier marriages and family life, and find greater sense of meaning and purpose in life. This is a result of their spirituality in his study. Now, these eight conditions that I just enumerated are the result of 3 decades of study by 5 prestigious medical journals. Now, unfortunately, this came out of the faith factor, Dr. Matthews' book, and he didn't give any indication of where those journals were, so you could look up and see. But I'm reporting what that book says. Now, a study of 92,000 people in Maryland in 1972 showed that churchgoers had 50% decreased death from heart disease, 56% decreased death from emphysema, 54% decrease in instances of cirrhosis of the liver, 53% decrease in suicide. And in 1995, in Dartmouth Medical School, Dr. Thomas Oxman had 232 patients, I think this is a study that you alluded to earlier, open heart surgery, and in the first 6 months postoperatively, there were no deaths in the patients who were firm believers. And strangely enough, he quoted 3 times higher, 3 times higher than zero. in the ones who did not have any faith. At any rate, I didn't see the study. This is an aberration in recording, I think. Now, in another study of 7,000 people, divorce rates were only half as much in church-going group. Some of the churches that we've gone to, it seems like it's higher. But I guess our observations are skewed since we know mostly church people. Now, how does faith work? Why do people who have faith and are strong in their spirituality have better health? Well, it's postulated that by Dr. Matthews that there's less stress, there's more equanimity. He feels that the appreciation of beauty and nature and music and so on has a positive effect on health. And there's more of that. There's more temperance, less smoking, less alcohol, etc. Better diet, better health habits in people who are spiritual. The concept of renewal and confession, and if a problem occurs, you confess it and start over. That is that renewal feature, he feels, is a positive feature on health. Community involvement, obviously selflessness and helping others, is looking away from you, not dwelling on your problems, is a positive feature. And strengthening effect from the others of faith, and this is, gets back to their community and the as support groups. And the meaning and purpose of life in people who are spiritual, and that's a helpful feature. And trust is another thing. Trust in God, trust in your higher power. Positive expectancy. You just expect that you're going to be healthier. And your faith allows you to expect good results from your surgery, etc. And love and the feeling of being cared for by family, your support group, church, and from God. Okay, now we'll focus on death and longevity.
Phil, can I ask you a question? Do you think that people of faith who are willing to accept and trust in a higher force or a higher being also are more trusting in the system? More trusting in more trusting in their physicians, or more trusting in what the authorities say, than someone who is more cynical and who doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in his higher being, but doesn't believe in a lot of other things either. And I just wonder if it's because it's my sense, my patients do very well when they. In contrast to what you were saying, do very well when they are willing to accept. If they know they're going to have to undergo a major surgery, they just kind of accept that with a, you know, I'm in God's hands and I'm in the surgeon's hands. Mm-hmm. And it's okay. I don't have to, I'm not worried about whether that surgeon really is in a partnership. I just hope, I trust that he's good.
Well, that's a part of the partnership is trust. Mm-hmm. You know, there can't be a partnership if there isn't trust.
When you get run over by a truck, you don't have time to develop trust. You just hope that the guy's good.
That's
right. You hope the system works.
That's where the faith comes in. I think that's where the faith
comes
in.
I think maybe you're answering that question, that people that do have that faith can transfer that faith.
Right.
Right.
I had that personal experience.
Could you tell us about it?
Yeah. Years ago, I've always had a strong faith, a strong, powerful belief in the greater power. I have a son who, at the age of 9 weeks, had, within 2 weeks, two strangulated hernias. They told me that there was no hope. I said, oh, yes, there is. And I placed my hands without thinking on the surgeon's hands. And I said, go with God, and it will work. And he said, after 25 years being a surgeon, that I transferred a strength to him. And it just felt like he wasn't in charge, and the power was greater than me. And I have always believed that myself.
And your son lived?
Oh, yes, he's 45 years old. He's 23 years old. And recovered very well. But I mean, my own self, I've had to face some very deep challenges in life, and I've always felt that power is what got me through.
Yeah.
It does.
Good. Okay, we're talking now about a Strawbridge study in 1997. This was in California, 7,000 patients, and followed over, the study was reported in 1997. It was a 28-year study, and the mortality rates that were for church attendees were examined at regular intervals and followed age, sex, health status, social support, and people who were regular weekly church goers had a mortality rate that was 36% lower than non-church goers. And in the male-female ratio, it was much higher in females. They apparently had more faith than the males.
They live longer.
That's why they live longer. Now, there was a study in Israel of 10,000 men over 23 years, and deaths from coronary disease were 38% in people of Orthodox faith, and if they were in didn't have faith or were in the secular group, 61 deaths. So 38 deaths in the Orthodox group and 61 deaths in the secular group.
You might lay some of that to the diet.
Okay, we're going to talk now about intercessory prayer and its effect on healing. Does it work? In the Alternative Medicine Handbook, by Barry Castletheth, He's a PhD. Several studies were reviewed, and all were double-blind. Now, do you know what double-blind is? That the patients don't know, and the caregivers don't know who's in the control group and who's in the treatment group. And there were two studies in 1960 in the British medical literature and found no statistical benefit from intercessory prayer. A recent New Mexico study involving Jewish and Christian people praying to relieve substance abuse problems specifically. They found no recorded effect on the recovery. The most famous study was done in San Francisco at General Hospital by Dr. Randolph Bird, reported in 1988. In this, they had 393 patients in the coronary care unit who all accepted the fact that they would allow people to pray for them. And half were prayed for and half were not. And the patients didn't know and the caregivers didn't know which group they were in. In the group that were prayed for, they prayed for survival. That's what the praying was for. There were 25 variables that were investigated and focused on. And six of these seemed to have positive effect. The others, there was no effect of the praying. And I'll enumerate the six. They were complications that resulted from their heart attacks. In the prayed for group, 2% had congestive heart failure as a complication. In the non-prayed for group, 10%. So five times as much heart failure. The need for antibiotics, for diuretics, which is probably related to the heart failure as well, but 3% in the prayed for group and 7% needed diuretics in the control group. Of the ones that got pneumonia as a complication, 2% in the prayed for group and 7% in the control group. Those who had cardiac arrest, 2% in the prayed for group and 7% in the non-prayed for group. 2% needed antibiotics in the prayed for group and 9% needed antibiotics in the control group. And those that needed intubation for airway, zero needed that in the prayed for group and 6% needed it in the control group. Now, this is a very, very difficult type of study from a scientific basis because, number one, you have to know about a couple of things that are very difficult to know about. The quality of the faith of the recipient of the prayer, the what you're actually praying for, and how to evaluate the results. It's not like, you know, you can measure something with an electrocardiogram or, you know, tell what the level of sodium is in the blood. There's so much wishy-washy, non-hard fact to focus on. It's difficult. And this study has been faulted by many and says this does is not worth much. There is these statistics that are there, and you can accept them as you wish. But it's a very, very difficult thing to study, and I think if you start with that, you can probably indicate, as I do, that these studies aren't going to tell us the answer. And so I will open this up for discussion on this point at this time on intercessory prayer. What do you think?
Can I ask a question? The people who were doing the praying, were they just random people that were chosen for the study? Were they chaplains in the hospital? Were they trusted friends or family members? Or were they personal pastors?
Well, I never saw the original study, but we have someone here who has.
I happen to have the original study.
He brought it with him.
And they were, and this is the direct quote from the study, the intercessors were chosen on the following basis. They were born-again Christians, according to the Gospel of John 3-3, with an active Christian life as manifested by daily devotional prayer and active Christian fellowship with the local church. Some were Catholics, some were Protestants, but they were all born-again Christian, or viewed themselves in that way.
So you don't know what the relationship was with the particular client they were
praying? No, they didn't know who the person was. They only knew them by their first name. And they knew that they were in the hospital, and so they would pray on a daily basis while these people were in the hospital. They would say, John is in the hospital, and they would say a prayer to God to intercede and to help John survive.
So they were not physically at the bedside?
Never, no.
The ultimate study on intercessory prayer.
Yeah.
Distance prayer.
And the individuals who were in the intensive care unit were... they had to agree that it was okay to have someone pray for them, and in some cases, nobody did pray for them in the study. Now, they may have had many other people praying for them, friends, relatives, themselves. So there's that muddling influence, and they may have had more friends praying for them. You can imagine if you had a wonderful congregation that knew you were in the hospital, there might be 50 people praying for you, and the study didn't know that, and they only had 3 people out there praying. So,
was it only one person praying?
I think
was it a one on one?
No, I think it was several. I would have
several praying groups.
Each patient was assigned to 3 to 7 intercessors.
Oh, okay.
But if you had 50 friends in your congregation that were
right.
praying every day and very hard, that would outweigh these 3.
Right.
Probably, maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. I mean, I guess only God can answer that one.
What information is given in the study about the spiritual situation of the patients who were being prayed for?
Only said that they would be willing
to be prayed. So we don't know if they fall on the bell curve of
they were active
at all. They
yeah.
what?
We don't know if they were active.
We don't know if they were not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Almost every hospital I know has a chaplain with chaplaincy service. So somewhere in the hierarchy of hospitaldom, they have figured out that the spiritual component is an important piece, or they would not be paying a chaplain, I can tell you that, because every penny is counted 5 times in the hospital anymore.
Yes.
Well, on the other hand...
Oh, good. We have a chaplain here.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, once when we had a medical emergency in our family, I found the chaplain and went in to pray, and afterwards I told a friend who had some experience there, and she said, oh, that's when they take people and tell them somebody's died. And I don't know whether litigation has anything at all to do with why they have a chaplain on staff, too. It's possible. It did occur to me.
Well, it is an important service in the hospital.
Oh, no question.
It's used a lot.
Carl?
In the figures you read, Phil, about the data, are there figures regarding reliability and level of confidence and T-test scores?
Are you kidding?
when you look at this study, and this is the only study that has quote demonstrated proof that intercessory prayer is effective. When you look at it overall, and other people have analyzed it, there is no difference in the two groups. When you analyze those two groups, there was no difference in mortality, there was no difference in outcome. There were differences in a number of interventions, and Phil has outlined those. More in the control group were intubated, but not more died. And so it's very hard to conclude from this study anyway. This doesn't prove that intercessory prayer works or doesn't work.
Well, or I'll argue with you a little.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they lived or died, but was that time period better or worse?
But on some indices,
the
group that got prayed for did worse. For instance, no, they did. Now, you know, I mean, you can be very selective and pick out, you know, more required anti-anginal agents. More had unstable. These are the people who were being prayed for. They had more chest pain. They had more angina than the group that wasn't prayed for. But
well,
they
that was good that they could feel it.
but they had less pneumonia, and and overall the mortality rates were the same. So I mean, you can go down. It's to answer the question statistically, you couldn't tell the difference in these two groups. Yeah. You could on a few indices, but not not when you looked at the groups as a whole.
You had a question?
Well, I think it's all well and good to have these wonderful scientific studies, and you can see from the reaction here that we're probably not putting too much credence to it. I put much more reliability in this lady's experience, personal experience of putting her hands on a surgeon's hands.
Yeah.
And I think that probably you find similar stories with a lot of people in this room. And I put more reliability in that.
Well, I want to tell you a personal story. This happened in my practice. I got a call from a friend, a colleague, a physician, said, I'm sending a patient into the emergency room by ambulance. It's a 7-year-old girl. He was called to their home, which was an old school bus. The father had multiple sclerosis and was unemployed, and they had no funds. They had 6 or 7 children living in a school bus. This child had been sick for 4 days with high fever. And she broke out in a rash, and they thought it was measles. They called this doctor because they knew him from the church that they went to. He came, and this was not measles. This was meningococcemia. The child had meningococcal meningitis and meningococcemia. She had hemorrhaged into her adrenal glands, and this was a situation that, you know, was very unlikely she could recover from. The ambulance rushed her to the emergency room. I was waiting there for her. The ambulance man took her out of the ambulance and said, she's gone. They pronounced her dead on the way over. We worked on revival and got her breathing going and got the heart going. And to my astonishment, my skill brought, in 20 minutes, we'd done all the sampling, spinal tap, blood samples, urine, EKG, X-ray, everything, and found that she was worse off than we thought, that her heart was riddled with this infection, all of her system. The chances of survival were zero. So we get everything hooked up, and I'm delighted that, you know, we could work so rapidly. I've never worked that fast before. Come out and talk to the mother and explain to her the depth of this problem. And she leaned across the table and took my hand in both of her hands and said, Dr. Dean, we'll pray for you. And I said, well, thank you, but what we need to pray for is your daughter. And she said, we prayed for her. We know she's going to get well.
I mean,
we talk about faith. The child recovered. And I thought, well, you know, she'll be a vegetable if she recovers. And I got Christmas cards from her every year. And she graduated from high school, valedictorian.
Monica, do you want to make some comments about your experience on faith and healing, or faith and the people you work with?
Well, I certainly think it's a positive effect on the lives of the residents that I serve, that people that have faith, they just generally seem to do better than those who may not have any faith connections in their life. Mm-hmm. And certainly the first aspect of support, the support of a community, of a pastor that visits, the friends, community, church people that come to visit, that really is life-sustaining for people. Loneliness can be deadly. I've seen a lot of lonely people that don't survive as well. So I think that aspect of support is very vital. And a chaplain can't do it all, so.
I have a question. Have you had experience with parish nurse?
Yes. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. becoming more and more.
Yeah, great idea.
An aspect through the churches in our community.
Mm-hmm. I wish
and
we could
hospice,
see more.
Hospice,
yeah.
Is,
hospice is the other.
Hospice is wonderful.
Talk about that.
Could you comment that? Diversity, religious diversity is something we're seeing, obviously, more and more. The United States become a melting pot anyway, but we're seeing, at least I'm seeing more, in a community where there's a lot of foreign students and a lot of people with very different beliefs, of how individuals of very different faith accept a chaplain of a given faith, and how your experience with that and your acceptance and how you deal with that.
In the last 10.5 years, I've been in a smaller town setting, about 20,000, and we don't have such diversity as basically of the Christian denominations. So I haven't had a Hindu or Muslim or etc. But in the cities where I served, then there was quite a diversity. And and a diversity among staff. Staff people who were Muslim or other backgrounds. I was generally quite well accepted in my ministry, although I usually gave a little devotion over the intercom each morning, and there was one time a Muslim staff person came down and took me to task about what I had said. So, so there was sometimes a little friction related to Christianness over against other.
Well, I think that's one of the things. It comes back to the partnership and everything. One has to be very careful, either in the role as a chaplain, a role as a physician, a role as a nurse, that one doesn't let one's own belief and belief system interfere with the relationship. And one really has to accept and foster and at least be tolerant. But when you're in a position of authority, as a physician might be in terms of trying to convince someone that they should have surgery or shouldn't have surgery or should take this medicine, not this medicine, doesn't stop pushing a religious belief and turn to someone, now you really need to be spiritual, we really need to pray or something like that, when the patient really might not want that kind of look. You know, I came here to get my surgery. I didn't come here. If I wanted church, if I wanted religion, I will go to my pastor, I'll go to my chaplain or whatever. So one just has to be very careful, I think, not to mix these things and not to trivialize religion. And I think some of these studies, and that may have been the point you made, is that when we try to make something scientific that's not scientific, mm-hmm. I mean, what is moving is when we hear these stories, the one that you told and one that Phil told, about how strong belief can lead to remarkable outcomes, almost miracles. And I think probably everyone here has seen that, or at least heard about it, or has felt it. Not to let a scientific study detract from that. But what does the scientific study mean? Because we're trying to fit this religious belief into a scientific model where these two areas are really very separate parts of people's lives. And I think we have to be very careful. I at least I feel we have to be very careful not to trivialize religion in the process of trying to see if it really works.
You feel that extends to hospice care as well, Phil?
That hospice care is...
Do you feel that extends to hospice care as well?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it does. If you're a born-again Christian hospice nurse and you have a Muslim or a Jew patient, there's a gulf there. And one just has to accept that gulf. That doesn't mean you can't care and take care of that patient, provide all the many parts of the support that they need. But as far as the religious support and that connection, they may need to get that from a different source.
And that would extend, I suppose, to a patient who was a nominal Christian or agnostic or atheist.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not the role that you're there for, but you are there to make sure that they get that support if they need it, if they ask for it or want it or indicate.
And that not only if you're a medical person, but also if you're, say, a chaplain coming to the hospice, that would be the same?
Sure.
The chaplains I've known have been really fantastic people. Mm-hmm. They have a way of coming in and not pushing, you know, it's always done with a question. Would you like me to pray with you?
Yes.
You know, and if they're, I said, well, that's okay, chaplain. Just your being here is enough. Great. They'll back off, and they. Mm-hmm. But at least that's the chaplains I've known. They've done just a wonderful job.
They tend to be very gentle people. I've worked with hospice, and the criteria that the federal government sets up, you have to have a chaplain in your service, and that chaplain does a spiritual assessment on every patient. And if that patient... If in their assessment, which is quite detailed of where they are spiritually and how they are spiritually, if it were to come up that they were something vastly different than what the chaplain could provide, a resource is found for that person to come into the home if they want it. And the chaplaincy service through hospice can always, it's like if you... Once a spiritual assessment is done and the government criteria is taken care of, then if they don't ever want to see the chaplain again, they don't have to. Some families really connect with that service and other families don't.
Any of you have any personal observations of healing by prayer?
Yes. I worked as a parish nurse for 5 years. And I prayed with people on a daily basis, both in the hospital and their homes and in many different situations. And I can give you an example of a gentleman who was an Alzheimer's patient. And one of the things Lola brought up and several people have brought up is touch. And I think touch is critically important. But I had a relationship with this gentleman over probably 25 years. And then as parish nurse, even on a more regular basis, and visited him in a local nursing home. And he had a bleeding problem, and the nursing home had sent him to the hospital for a transfusion, and they put him in the ICU unit. And whenever you move an Alzheimer's patient out of their familiar surroundings, it can be very difficult for them. And I probably arrived at the hospital half an hour after the individual had. And when I walked into the room, he recognized me. I wasn't a stranger like everybody else who was doing their job medically very well. And I went over and I took his hand and I could see the fear in his eyes because he did not understand what was going on around him. And I just sat down in the chair and I held his hand. And when the staff finished getting the blood hung and doing all the paperwork that they needed to do, the doctor came in and asked who I was, and I told him who I was and that I was from our church and that I knew this individual. The physician asked me if I would be willing to pray with the three of them. So we all took hands, and I prayed for both the physician and for the patient, and the patient literally melted. And when his eyes opened, there was no more fear. there was a sense of an element of trust. He still didn't have a clue as to what was going on around him. And the physician looked at me and he said, I don't believe what I see. He said, I cannot believe what's happening in front of me. And it was a complicated thing when you looked at it. There was a trust relationship I had with the client. There was a spiritual piece of it that was going on. And all I prayed for was for comfort and for peace. I knew that he could not understand what was going on. And every time he became extremely agitated, they would call me. I would go to the hospital, and I would pray with him. And this sort of peace and countenance came over him for a space of time. And it didn't last for hours and hours and hours, but it made a huge difference. He understood the spiritual connection somehow.
One of the things that when you pray, you know, we need to maybe sometimes be careful of what we pray for. We can't always pray for a cure, but we can always pray for comfort and health and peace. We have the books here today that Phil has used. One of them is available at the bookstore. It's, I'm not sure which one it is. The rest of them are not, but the rest of them will be in the library here. They were donated to Holden.
And they're all available through your private bookstore, right?
No, I don't. But the bookstore here would be happy to order them for you, I'm sure. I'm not sure about the 10% discount. Okay, tomorrow we are going to get into what I might call woo-woo land. But tomorrow we're going to cover a number. I think there's something like 50 different healing alternatives. We're going to do it rather quickly because otherwise we will never get through the list. But some of them are things that you're very familiar with. Others are things that you may have just heard about. Some of them are in the news right now. And so I think everybody needs to kind of just have at least a working relationship with what some of these things are. So I'll have a list for you to make your notes on so you don't have to bring paper. So we'll see you tomorrow morning at 8:30.